Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. You are encouraged to join in this discussion at 877-300-7645. I'm going to share one closing comment about the something I did not convey during the first hour that I think needs to be said. There is a reason that beyond the fact that Muslims are following Muhammad's example, they're being good Muslims when they're enraged and they kill around the world. And what I would encourage people to do is go to your favorite news feeds and just click on the pictures. I want you to look at the pictures of the faces and the gestures of those who are burning U.S. embassies and killing their own people. I want you to see the rage. I want you to have an appreciation where God says that he hates religion. I want you to have an appreciation of what God says, that he sees the faces of those who are religious as if they were smeared with bull dung. You will appreciate why. Now, there's something else that I have not really tied together, which will tell you what this means to you and your family. Because of the failure of governments around the world to create sane economic policy, and the fact that they are working to deprive people of freedom, oppressing their own citizens, the world is moving towards hopelessness. In the Islamic world, it's always been hopeless. You know, there has never really been a viable economy in the Islamic world. And occasionally, one nation maybe will look viable for a short period of time, but you look at the cross-section of the 55 countries that are Islamic, they're all impoverished. They're all hell holes. And if you want to know what hell is like, look at an Islamic country. People are deprived of hope. They're deprived of economic opportunity. They're deprived of an education. And so what happens in a country like Egypt, like Sudan, like Somalia, like Pakistan, where people are deprived of economic prosperity, they're deprived of hope, they're poisoned by such a despicable religion? Well, the economies, the country, everything falls apart. And what you see is these people who have nothing to live for, only something to die for. And what happens in countries like this is the very perpetrators of these conditions, the religious leaders and the politicians, what they all do is they blame a boogeyman out there for the plight of the people. Oh, it's those Jews. Oh, it's those Americans. They're working against you. If it weren't for those Jews and those Americans, oh, then everything would be wonderful here. The reason that your life is so miserable is because of them. And that's what people do. Adolf Hitler did it masterfully. Stalin and Lenin did it. It's always the boogeyman. It's always somebody out there. You know, with the Mao, it was the imperialists. Someone to blame for their own failures, for the failures they impose on their people. And as the world moves to the tribulation, which is just 14 years distant, this hopelessness will spread across the world. You will find this same hopelessness and despair in America, in Australia, New Zealand, throughout Europe, as it is in the Islamic world. People will have nothing to live for, only something to die for. And this is what we are bringing upon ourselves. There's only one way out. Only one path away from all of this, away from the destructive and poisonous nature of religion and politics, from militarism and failed economic schemes. There is a single path to hope, to life, away from this corruption. Yah presents it throughout his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. The means to it is the covenant, where we become adopted by God, become immortal, become perfect. We grow and live with him. He has a seven-step path from this polluted religious and political world to his home. Not one in a million people understand it. Not one in a million people observe it. But it is there nonetheless and has been there as his invitation to embrace him, to come to know him, to respond to the very terms and conditions of the covenant that he is offering. It's an invitation. But like all invitations that God has given us, these mikre, these seven steps that provide entrance into his home, these seven parties, seven celebrations, seven feasts, they are given to us by way of an invitation. And like all invitations, we have to separate ourselves enough from the clutter and confusion of the world to recognize that government is not something we ought to rely upon. We ought not rely upon our military, our economic schemes, our religion, or our favorite political party, nor endorse them. We need to walk away from them and that noise and their corruption and that poison long enough to be able to see what God is actually inviting us to read the invitation. To read the invitation. You'll find the invitation in the Torah, a book that Christians loathe because they think it's law, that Paul did away with it, that was nailed to their cross, the Christian cross. None of that, of course, is true. God's testimony has never been annulled. It never will be annulled. And on that invitation, you need to read, what are we being invited to? What is the timing of these parties? Where do we meet? What are we celebrating? And when you come to know the nature of these parties, two of which are on our immediate horizon, you know, we're about ready to celebrate Yom Kippurim, the Day of Reconciliations, followed 5 days later by Sukkah, shelters. And I dare say not one in a million people know what these days represent or how to avail themselves of their promises. Well, that is why we're studying the Torah. You know, we're beginning here by coming to understand the creation account so that we can trust the testimony of the Spirit who created the universe and told us about it, who explained why he created the universe, which was for a singular thing. He wants to separate us from these great travesties of humankind, from the poison and corruption, despair and hopelessness, the death, destruction of human religious and political schemes, so that we can live with him, protected by him, sheltered by him, growing with him as his children. So the testimony begins, in the beginning, the Almighty created and was alongside and closely associated with the spiritual world and the material realm. And the natural physical world existed as a formless, orderless, and empty void, obscured in darkness, along with the presence of the great commotion, Big Bang, if you will, an inaccessible and mysterious energy. To this God added the Almighty's Ruach, which is the feminine manifestation of the divine power of God, hovered over, ministered to, and cleansed according to the presence of the waters. Yesterday we took time to be deliberate as it relates to the pronunciation of these words that were used in this testimony, and the nature of translation and transliteration. So now that we know what the words mean, what the names convey, and how they should be rendered, let's shift our attention back to the very meaning that can be derived from Yah's message to us. There is a parallel between Bereshith 1:2 and the primary purpose of God's Spirit. And that is how God teaches. The first time he introduces a term, he explains it. The feminine noun Ruach, which was translated Spirit, of Elohim, which was translated God, Rakoth, washes sin from our souls. She, and the Spirit, Ruach, is a feminine noun, purifies. She renews mortal man by Rakoth, covering us with Yahweh's garment of light. And she, Rakoth, hovers over us in a protective way, nurturing and enlightening our minds. As this story unfolds, we will discover that the Ruach spirit highlights, by contrast, the mortal nature of our nefesh souls. You see, we will be told that all animals, including humans, have a nefesh soul. From slugs to snakes, to eagles and insects, to humans, dogs, all animals have a soul. That means that we are conscious of our environment. Soul is something that the scientific community still knows nothing about. They don't know what a soul is comprised of. They have no idea where it comes from, where it goes to. There aren't even any scientific studies on the nature of a soul or the ability to measure a soul. Here is one of the most fundamental aspects to life. In fact, the most fundamental aspect to life. The soul. Consciousness. And there isn't a scientist in the world who understands what it is, nor any research focused at attempting to understand of what it is comprised. But souls are immortal. All of them. Including human souls. And unless those souls are associated with that which is immortal by way of spirit, because spirit is like energy, and time simply exists forever in the presence of energy on a photon of light, that unless a soul is enlightened by Yah's light, then it is mortal. It will cease to exist. Most are unaware that consciousness is something which both men and animals are said to have received in the sixth day of creation. Shortly thereafter, we will learn when we study Yah's testimony that the Ruach of Elohim, the Spirit of God, is distinguished from the Nesalma Che. Now, Nesalma Che is the conscience of life. This, too, is an extraordinarily important concept that is hidden in errant Bible translations. Nesalma differs from nefesh. Nefesh is our soul, our consciousness, our ability to be aware of our surroundings. It is our mortal existence. It is our unique persona, our consciousness, our nefesh soul. Our nesalma is something entirely different. It is our conscience, our ability to be moral, to differentiate between right and wrong. We were using our nesama, our conscience, our seat of judgment, in the first half of this program to determine why Muslims are enraged. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. We encourage you to call 877-300-7645. What we were talking about before the last break is the nesalma and how the nesalma differs from the nefesh. Don't apologize here for using the Hebrew terms because we are taking the time to explain what they mean. A nesalma and a nefesh are different concepts. The nefesh is our soul. It is our consciousness, our ability to observe and respond to that which is around us. That's the thing that differentiates animals from plants. Plants do not have a soul. Animals do. They're aware of their environment, and they can respond to their environment. And so humans are just like all other forms of animals, according to Yahweh, and according to now what we know about in science, in that we all have souls, consciousness. But according to God, He gave mankind something different, something in addition to consciousness. The term that He used is nefesh. Excuse me, the term that He used is nesalma. I misspoke. The term that He used, nefesh, is, of course, consciousness. But the thing that He gave man that made man like Him, God, the thing that He gave humankind that made men and women different than animals, was this nesalma, this ability to differentiate between right and wrong. Good and bad, that which is reliable and that which is not. Truth versus lies. It is the seat of judgment. It's the ability to exercise good judgment. It's the very thing that political correctness seeks to thwart, is our nesama, our conscience, this ability to know when we are being misled, this ability to recognize the truth. It's the most valuable, I think, the most valuable gift of the three gifts that God has given us. I view it as being the most valuable of them. You know, he gave us mortal existence, but this mortal existence is fleeting unless we use our nesama effectively to come to understand that religious institutions and political institutions and military institutions are not reliable and that they're deceiving the vast preponderance of people, and that we come to appreciate that God's testimony can be trusted. We come to know him and what he is offering. The only means to do that is by exercising our nesama. This program is based upon exercising our nesama, our conscience. And it is the one thing that differentiates us from all other forms of animal life. So, continuing with this presentation, God, Yahweh, told us that he, Rakoff, was rapidly moving, that he was hovering over and protecting his infant creation at this phase of what he used the term, to use his term, the Big Bang. And, of course, it is consistent with the current scientific thought. There was a time in which the physical laws were stretched. It occurred early on during what is called the inflationary period of the cosmos's formation. Physicists claim that most of the physical laws, if not all of them, were suspended, enabling a great instantaneous expansion. It was 10 to the 43rd power increase in size, according to them, in 10 to the minus 34th seconds, which, of course, is impossible. But, you know, stating things that are impossible is common in the realm of science. All of this, they claim, was to take place instantly after the Big Bang commenced. The issue here is that this transition to the time before time and the time of time, this transition from energy to the formation of matter, is beyond our comprehension. So this period of Rakoff, of quickly moving and hovering over, was so extreme that two objects, according to science, that were an inch apart prior to the inflationary period would be 27 septillion light years separated after it. I don't really know how big a septillion is, but trust me when I say 27 septillion of them, measured in light years and not miles, after it. That's big. Not only did the inflationary period commence in the first day of creation, its influence over our reality remains at the heart of all universal explanations. And we're going to return to this explanation of not only how and when God created the universe, but most importantly of why he created the universe right after the break. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. To Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. You can engage in this discussion, as Jason is about to do, by calling 877-300-7645. I promised that I would continue a bit with this, and we'll then turn our attention to Jason's question. What I had shared is that coming to understand the nature of Ruach, of Mayim water, Ruach spirit, and of Rakoff purification, helps us understand not only the story of how the universe was created, but more importantly, why it was created. Remember the why question that Scott asked in the first hour of our program, that if you really want to understand, you got to know why? Well, everyone has a motivation. God has a motivation. God didn't create the universe just for giggles. He did it for a reason. Why did he create the universe? Why did he conceive life? Why did he give man three gifts, mankind three gifts? Our mortal life, our nefesh soul, free will, and a nesama, a conscience. Why did he offer his Torah teaching to us? In fact, I think Jason's question is going to be, why did he send the Messiah? What was the purpose of that? Why did he do it? Well, the why of creation is also shared in his account when you come to know the meaning of the words. You see, God in this plan illuminates his purpose, which is to form a relationship with humankind. Now, to accomplish this, he must redeem us. He must use water to cleanse and purify. He must use combined spirit, water, and purification. And these things have to follow. Lifelessness, which was tohu, remember? And bohu, confusion. And chosek, darkness. They are the solution for these things. For there to be this understanding of light, there must be the contrast of darkness. For there to be truth, there must be the contrast, which is confusion. For life to be meaningful, there has to be death, lifelessness. It is only in the contrast that these things are meaningful. You know, for there to be love, there must be the capacity for anger. All of these things are important. And Yah's Ruach spirit, Mayim water, and Rakoff purification are the solution that provide the contrast from lifelessness to life, from confusion to enlightenment, to truth, to understanding, and from chosek darkness to being enlightened, being in God's light. Yah's solution, that we are being asked to walk from man's confusing, dark, and spiritually lifeless world of religion and politics to God's home, a journey which is facilitated and illuminated by his Ruach spirit. Now, with those thoughts, let's turn our attention to Jason. Jason is from Pennsylvania. I remember a Jason that was with us just a few days ago. Is this the same Jason?
Yes, it is. Yada, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Like I said before, I mean, you speak on such a high level, and all the stuff you just said there, I could talk to you for countless hours on just those things, but I really want to get to my question this time, because last time we went off, you know?
Yeah.
So I just want to get right to it. As I understand it, the law was given to Moshe. Is that the right way to say Moses?
Well, that's the right way to say his name. Moshe means to draw out, but there was no law.
Oh, okay.
So if we don't stop there, we can't get to your question. There is no law.
I mean the Torah.
But the Torah is not law.
The commandments.
As law. Nope, there's no commandments either.
Okay.
There are no commandments. There are no commandments. There is no law.
See, this and is if what we don't, saying. You blow my mind.
Yeah, I know. But you see, if we don't have the right foundation, we don't even know what the right questions are.
Right.
And I'm not being critical. I like you, Jason. I mean, I love the fact that you call in and that because you're asking questions that I'm sure many people also want to know. So the very fact that you're open to me saying I can't proceed with the question because the opening statement is incorrect, and that you're eager to understand why that opening statement is incorrect is extremely valuable. So understand here that we're engaging now in a discussion again because you prompted a very powerful discussion. So I want to praise you here. This is not I'm not being critical.
No,
there is no law.
No, okay, I understand what you said. Okay, what do we call Moses or
Moshe.
Thank you.
Yes.
When he went up on the mountain, what happened?
Yahweh, through Yahusha, dictated his teaching to Moshe. Moshe scribed what he was told. So Moshe's role in receiving and transmitting Yah's Torah, which means teaching, instruction, guidance, and direction. The Hebrew word Torah is based on the Hebrew word Yara. The verb Yara means to teach, to instruct, to guide, and to direct. It does not mean law. And so the Torah is Yahweh's source of guidance to humankind, his source of teaching to humankind, his source of direction and instruction to humankind. When you want to pursue the why word, which is the most critical word of all, to understand why, the only way that you can understand why is to understand what someone's motivation is, and God's motivation is presented in his Torah guidance to us. So Moshe was the scribe of Yah's teaching and direction that we use, that we call by the name Torah, and we use it as a title to describe the first five or six books of Yah's testimony. The reason I say five or six is there is ample reason to include the book of Yahusha,
right,
in the collection of the Torah. But the moment you say that the law was given to Moshe, then we're off in the wrong direction. There is no law, and there are commandments. There is Torah teaching.
I understand. So I want to get to my question. This is I know the premise was off. So but you've corrected me. I understand what you're saying now.
Okay.
So what was the purpose of Yahusha coming in the first place then? Trying to understand, was his sacrifice meaningful, what he did?
Yeah. First of all, let me ask you, Jason, how many times do you think he's been here?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's...
How many times do you think that his visit in 33 CE, which was year 4000 Yah, was the first time he's been here?
In that form?
Because if you understand... Yeah. No, yeah, sure. Well, it's just that's the only form of Yahusha is a man. That is the only form that Yahusha has ever taken. So, yes, in that form. Has Yahusha, which is a diminished manifestation of God, a corporeal representation set apart from God,
right,
has the formation of that particular manifestation of God that we know as Yahusha. That's the correct name, by the way, for the bogus concept of Jesus. There is no Jesus, never has been a Jesus, will never be a Jesus. His name is Yahusha. So the question is, how many times has he been here?
I have no idea, but all I can say is Yada. I respect you totally, but I had an extremely... I came to... who you call Yahusha, very strongly by calling out the name Jesus. So I guess I'm saying is...
That's not, and you have to be very careful about your feelings because he won't respond to the name Jesus. He hates Jesus. God hates Jesus.
Woo.
Hates him. So hates him. God hates Jesus, despises him.
Wow.
And it's not who I call Yahusha. That's his name. That's who Yahweh calls Yahusha. The name Yahusha is not my name. It's the name Yahweh chose. Because that name explains who he is and what he did. He's not a separate individual. There's no Trinity. He's not a unique individual. Yahusha means Yahweh saves. Yahusha tells us that it is Yahweh himself that is saving us. That's what it means. Yahusha means Yahweh saves.
Well,
it doesn't mean Jesus saves. It means Yahweh saves. So when God is really clear about corruptions of his name, there is nothing he despises more in the entire universe than the corruption of his name.
Well, all I could
his name is important.
No, I understand that. I totally understand that. And ever since that I've really done deep study, you know, I try my best never to call God. I try not even to say God anymore. I try to say Yahweh. But, you know, if what you're saying is true, And salvation can't salvation from a situation can't come from the name of Jesus, then you just completely destroyed my entire world.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's good. There is no salvation through Jesus. God hates Jesus. There was no Jesus. Jesus is a myth. And the Christian Jesus, it's a name that was created in the 17th century. The name didn't even exist prior to the 17th century. That the Christian Jesus is modeled after Dionysus. The first quotation that Paul puts in the mouth of his Jesus is Dionysus's most famous line. It's difficult to kick against the goat.
So the
Christian Jesus is a God who dies and is resurrected, like all the sun gods of old, just like Dionysus. In fact, you know, with Dionysus, his mom was one of the Graces. So how the grace, you know, salvation through faith in the gospel of grace.
No, I've heard all this.
Yosha.
You don't even believe in the resurrection then? There was no resurrection?
There's no reason to believe in anything. Why would you choose to believe if you can know?
Okay.
I mean, why would anybody, once you can come to know, why would you choose faith? Faith is for those who don't know. Belief is for those that don't understand. So no, I don't believe. I know. I don't have faith. I understand. Now, I know and understand, Jason, not because I'm unique, but because God provided the testimony necessary for us to know him and understand. We'll return with Jason and this program, Shattering Myths, and we'll talk about belief and knowing, faith and understanding, as well as so-called resurrections. Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. This is the last segment of our program today. Jason has asked so many good questions, and fortunately, we've turned his world upside down, which is a very good thing, because until the world of religion is turned upside down, it's very difficult to come to understand what God is offering in place of this. 6 minutes that remain in this program, Jason, for me to respond to everything that you have asked by way of questions. And so the best I'm going to be able to do is give a good start on it and then ask you on Tuesday. Now, Monday of next week, Larry is going to host the show. And I would ask that, and you're more than welcome to call in if you wish to Larry. He's absolutely prepared to answer these questions. But also, if you would like, I would encourage you, Jason, to call in on Tuesday in the second half of the program, when we'll continue this discussion. But let me begin by saying that that died on Passover, on when Yosha was observing Passover, is his physical body. His physical body was symbolic of the Passover lamb. And so his physical body died, but his physical body did not die until the Spirit of God separated from him. That's why he said, my God, why have you separated from me? Why have you forsaken me? And so as God's Spirit went back to Yahweh, the set-apart Spirit went back to Yahweh, the body and soul of Yosha was on the upright pole, serving as the doorway to life. His body ceased to live, but his soul, his consciousness, which we talked about in the first part of this program, continued to thrive. His body, as consistent with the promises of Passover and the instructions on Passover, that night had to cease to exist. So his physical body did not remain in the empty tomb. That night it was incinerated. It ceased to exist in strict observance of Passover. His soul, his consciousness, the very essence of his mortal existence now, went to Sheol to fulfill unleavened bread. Had it not gone to Sheol in our stead to remove sin from our souls, those of us who accepted his gift of Passover life would become immortal but eternally separated from God. And so Passover is followed by matzah, unleavened bread, and matzah, what his soul did the next day, which Christians don't even contemplate, was vastly more important, because it is the day where sin is removed from our souls. Then on the first celebration of Bukkudim, of first fruits, His soul and his spirit were reunited. And what Christians fail to appreciate is the fact that there's only one common theme among the three eyewitness accounts on that day. And the one common theme among the three eyewitness accounts that day, who saw him as they did not recognize him. He was an entirely different and new creation. There was no bodily resurrection that would be a liability, and his body ceased to exist the evening of Passover. His soul and his spirit were reunited. And just as Einstein explained to us and Yah told us some 3,500 years ago, that energy and matter are the same thing. They are not equivalent, but they are the same. And so now as a spiritual being, Yahweh, Yahusha, could transform any percentage of his spiritual energy into matter. He was a new creation, Yah's son, Yah's child, just as we are when we celebrate Bukurim. The message of those 3 days is the fulfillment of Pesach Matzah. Matzah and Bukurim provide fulfillment of the first three of the covenant's benefits or promises. By Pesach, we receive eternal life. By Matzah, we are perfected. By Bukurim, we are adopted into God's home as his children. That is what happened on those days. God did not die. Death is not the resolution for sin. There was no physical resurrection. His body ceased to exist on Passover that evening. And so it is good, Jason, that the myths of Christianity are one by one being plucked from you, that they are being removed, that you are distancing yourself from the religion, because God has a wonderful relationship that he is offering. And the terms of and conditions of his covenant require you to walk away from this religion. So the very fact that aspects of your religious past have been shown to be untrue is good, because now you'll be even freer, even more willing to walk away from them, which is the lone prerequisite of the covenant. Well, and then you now are in a position, Jason, to walk to God and to become perfect, to trust and rely on him and the covenant promises that he has offered you.
So I'm one step ahead.
You betcha. Jason, do us yourself and our listeners the favor of either calling in on Monday and speaking with Larry, or returning and calling in again on Tuesday when we have more time. I appreciate your call very much, and I appreciate you, Jason.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you...